Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of Just Another Kill Team Podcast, connecting Kill Team communities across the globe. Today, we are talking to the worldwide map pack maker. I'm sure you're all familiar. We've had a lot of people playing on these Turning Point Tactics maps. Welcome, Ryan.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Ryan. You know, we met at the World Championships, and we talked a little bit about the maps, mostly because some of the maps at the World Championships have a little bit of echo for the Turning Point Tactics maps. We got to chat a little bit about that. You did really well with Star Striders, the first one in our group and the best record, if I remember correctly, in Group 1.
Yeah, so I went 4-1, I think, which was the highest in Group 1. Yeah. But just Commandos, and no surprise, like, just Commandos, just keep me out.
Yeah,
I did lose one game to Breaches, but the rest of them were just Commandos. So.
Yeah, Commandos are definitely one of those rough matches for Star Striders, just because they bad touch so hard.
I haven't yet figured out how to win that game. I got close. I got a semi-draw, but we went to 20.7. I lost. But I got close, but I have not figured it out. And I think that for me is probably going to stop me from playing Star Striders for a bit, because I don't like when I can't figure out. Well, maybe I'll try and have another go, but yeah.
I think, you know, with the new nerfs, at least you're not getting aggressed on turn one, which probably would help a lot in that matchup, just because you can line up a couple range threats to deal with the first sneaky boy, and then maybe you can catch ranges later on with a new frontier shooting.
So I think, unfortunately, not. Like, it only helps you on open board, which I think was the better of the matchups. I think ITD is the worst matchup for Commandos versus Commandos, because... So they can do their sneaky git the same way they can. They can do shush, and they still have a commando knob in the midboard halfway up. He can be on engage if he wants to be with the dynamite, or he can just be on conceal, open a hatchway and charge you and kill you. So unfortunately, that matchup hasn't changed. And I think really it's only the cheese that's gone. So like the good players.
Yeah, the good commando players still have their good days. Yeah. You know, I guess on that note, we're going to be talking about Exaction Squad later, maybe as a slight change of pace, because Star Striders on In the Dark against Commandos is probably not going to be a tournament winning match anytime soon. But, you know, we'll also talk about how you design maps and kind of the impact that your map pack has had on the global community since then, since we do love talking to TOs all the way around the globe. And we've definitely had TOs talk about how they've been using your map pack from time to time.
That's awesome. It's weird to see how like far and wide it's gone, to be honest. Like, you get people from like Germany, you get people from France, you get people from the US, people from Australia saying, oh, hey, yeah, yeah, we use your map pack. And I'm like, that is an odd feeling to think that something I made has somehow managed to go that far, you know. But at the same time, it's pretty cool. So, yeah, but happy to talk about it.
Yeah, before we get into all the nitty-gritty, we wanted to talk about a little bit of normal life stuff. What's been going on for everyone?
Well, this is coming out on Christmas Day. We're recording it a little before Christmas. So, first of all, Merry Christmas to everyone that is listening on or right after Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you all. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for joining us here. You know, we've had one of our sponsors, Dakota Luster's Workshop, his laser for his small business actually went down recently. So I just wanted to give it a quick little shout out that, you know, the guy who's running LVO has run into a little bit of financial difficulties. So in case anybody wants to go support, we'll put his GoFundMe in the link. And if anybody wants to get anything off his Etsy shop, the link will be there as well.
Maybe that little bit of Christmas cheer can go and help out a friend in need, huh? We'll see.
Hopefully. I've been painting Howling Banshees for the new Blades of Cain.
The next broken team. Nice.
Well, hopefully they're not broken. They only got 8 models. How broken could they really be, right?
Well, Void Dancers came out, they only had 8 models, and they were totally fine. That'll be fun. It'll be interesting to see how they do. I reckon they're going to be really strong, personally.
We'll yeah.
have to wait and see,
you know,
I guess.
On that topic, you know, when you're building map packs, do you actually try to take into account the different kinds of playstyles? I know that at LVO, Dakota in the past has built maps around the Vetguard Pathfinder dominance, just like mushing things around a little bit, just to make sure that there are advantages in certain spots. I'm just curious, you know, since your map pack has had a big change on the meta, I think, for a lot of players, have you tried to take into account some of the cheesier things that teams could do, or do you try to make a more generic map pack that you think just plays well most of the time?
Yeah, so actually I spent a lot of time thinking about like the various combos people have and how they can break a map and try to avoid them doing that. And I even on version one tried to screen out some of the recon tac ops that were too easy to score, in my opinion, like the where you could place a recover item and that sort of stuff, but it just became too difficult. But a lot of it is trying to focus on some of the real cheese that the teams have. So, and it is deliberate. Like there's a lot of obscuring on my map between the deployment zones, and that's to stop teams like Vetguard doing a turn one long range grenade lob with a spotter or something like that. Like to try and get rid of the real cheese alpha strikes. I think that is boring. So I did try my hardest to try and account for it for as many teams as possible. But there is some things you can't account for. And I don't have any access to what's coming up in future either. So like before my map pack was made, like Keld Cults weren't a thing, Felger weren't a thing. And then these really dominant melee teams turn up and everyone goes, oh my God, they're really good on this map. And I'm like, well, Blooded were the best thing at melee. And they weren't winning anything at the time. So
there was like a handful of players playing Blooded to like reasonable success. Yeah. But I think all of them had mentioned that In the Dark is really where their hunting ground was. Because you it's more melee centric, but it ended up being that your map pack came out right around melee summer.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and it was, so it actually came out before, but like when it got picked up and more people started using it was during that period. And there is a little bit of, I guess, like caution to people of like careful what you wish for a little bit, because we had such a long period of shooting dominance, and then the map pack came out, and that was playable around now for elite teams and that sort of stuff. The main melee teams have been nerfed. It's still really strong for commandos. I think they're going to be like, I don't think commandos have been nerfed really at all, which is a bit of a shame. Like it seems on paper, but I think in application it won't. So they're still going to be really strong on those maps. But the other teams are at least toned down a little bit. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. You know, I think for the most competitive players that they want a bit more danger in the mid board, which I do get. I think that just naturally lends itself to high activation count, large shooting teams. So like if you're a Pathfinder player and a Vetguard player, that's exactly what you want. You want to open mid board where you can just wait out your opponent and then go forward and score. And really punish them if they do anything. And like, and the best they're going to do is kill like a chaff model, right? So that's the rub, right? And it is a real hard balance. And I think I also invite people, you know, like, please make more maps. You know, like I'm trying. It's from one perspective, but it'd be cool to see what people come up with. And sometimes you might see a little unique variation on a map, and you go, that is a really interesting way of doing something I've never thought about doing before. Yeah, it came from like London, where people started reversing the Octarius, right? So that it was completely exposed from the
points. It's just we're trying to make them L heavy shaped walls with that happen to have vantage that you can use, but it's no longer like a safe vantage because it is. Yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit too safe when there's four of those on most maps.
Exactly. Yeah. So I try to account for other teams as best I can, but there's always an element to it which is you can't account for everything, right? The game is too complex and too good. But I always try to, a few principles when I make the map, I try to make it so that you can use a dash to get to something that's impactful. Like, so there should be something that you can use a recon dash or into the breach dash to get to, or plunderers, whatever. And I try to have it so that you can score all the tac ops. So it should be possible to max any tac op on my maps. And there shouldn't be a way that you can just be zoned out of scoring, which is another impact, like another, I think, really important thing, right? Like, you don't want to turn up and go, oh, I'm playing recon, and someone goes, well, if I take this side, you now can't use secure vantage, and like that just denies you an option. So, it's a work in progress, and we'll see what version 3 brings, but more refinement, I think.
Have you seen the new maps that are coming out for LVO that are custom In the Dark maps?
Yeah, I have, and they're really interesting, and I think I'll be interested to see how they play, because I think one of the issues on, say, some Into the Dark maps are very, very like sealed off, and some of them are complete shooting galleries, right? Like in the standard map pack, which plays really weird, because like one of them, it's the one with the massive room in the middle, and it's got like two hatches either side, and your entire.
Oh yeah, I think channels that everyone hates. It's like one big room and then two side rooms that are cut in half, and if you're playing against Voidscarred, you better be in the middle room where you're just all your barricades are on one side, because if you have anyone out. They're in your backline dropping a Shredder Blast on like four dudes, just get deleted.
That's exactly it. So that map is bizarre. It doesn't play Into Dark at all. It feels like a worse open board. But it's interesting to see that he's brought in an asymmetric Into the Dark, which I think is a good change, because Into the Dark as it stands at the moment is very it's symmetrical. Your attacker defender is basically a flat buff to attacker. So I like the fact that he's brought in a little bit of, you know what, there's some stuff here and there's not some stuff there.
He also nerfed recon on his maps because half of the boards have no rooms to do for secure room, which is funny.
That was my one criticism, is like, if you're on secure room, you go, oh, I can't actually score that.
Yeah.
So that's my
I always remind people, I'm like, when I go to LVO this year, I'm planning to remind people, like, look, this room has no rooms, do not take it if you're going to take recon.
You just lose TVP. It's like, sorry, dude. Like, you just put the wrong side.
Oh, you played on autopilot for a little bit too long. You're done.
So, no, I love the asymmetry of it. I think it's going to be really interesting to see. I'm hoping to get out to LVO. I don't know if I'm going to be able to play yet. I'm out there for work during that period.
I
get Friday off. It's 3 days now rather than the two. So
it is.
I was like, oh, yeah, I've got the weekend off and we had to do it. And then it was like, oh, it's 3 days. And I was like, oh, no. Like, no, I don't know. No.
Hopefully if you are in the area and you have some time, you can come by, because me and Jason will be there. For any listeners who are going to LVO, if you want to say hi to the Just Another Kill Team podcast and Ryan from Turning Point Tactics, hopefully we'll all be there.
I'll definitely put my head in. Whatever happens, I'll put my head in at some point. But hopefully I can play. So we'll see. I want to see how they play. I want to see how they feel, because they look very interesting to me.
So you're feeling broadly positive about the Q4 balanced data slate, I assume?
Yeah, I think overall there's some pretty good changes there. I think we can probably foresee a few problems coming. Like my gut says that people will think the commanders have been nerfed and that they haven't been. Really at the high levels. Just the cheese.
I think they only got one actual sizable nerf at a top level play, and it's really just the bomb squig can no longer take APL buffs. So between the combination of Shush and +1 APL, it used to just, you could go anywhere and delete anything, and now you only get the Shush and the move, so you have about 11 inches versus a 14 inch explosion, which is a sizable nerf, but that's really the only nerf. Now you just have to play the game like a normal person instead of getting just a free win on setup.
And I've seen people play around that, right? It's like good commando players can just throw a smoke grenade right into the middle of the board and move dash their squig into the middle of it. And then if they win initiative on turning point two, it just goes and kills someone. If they don't win initiative, you now have to spend your first activation killing a guy that you don't care about. Like really, they don't care about. It's just an extra activation. Whilst they then all have all their other threats go and do the things they want to do. And then on Into the Dark, I don't know of a map where, apart from that massive shooting lane, where this bomb squid can't just reach wherever it needs to, like with a Shush forwards and then combined with the 8-inch charge. So, yeah.
The only thing is, at least they have to use the Shush now. So it's like committing a CP and some other resources. Whereas before it was like your leader, your comms just stands next to it and you kind of get all of it for free anyway. So it's like, it is a nerf, and that's probably the only nerf, because the other stuff was like, all right, you just had free. It was just too free before. Like, you weren't playing against half the teams.
And it was boring, because as well, like, when every commando player is using the exact same tactic and the exact same ploys every single time, you speak to anyone during that tournament, you go, what are you spending your 7 CP on? They go, 4 just to scratch, 1 Shush, 2 forward deploys, and you go, sweet. Like, do you ever change that? No. Is it matchup dependent? No. All right, okay, so...
And you also, and I think most of them were also playing Seek and Destroy, because you're like, well, I'm going to have 3 guys able to do route on turn 1, so someone's going to route.
Yeah, and that's basically what everyone did. So, I think they're still going to be there. Kazakin's a really interesting change. I haven't played him yet, so I don't know what it's going to feel like. But that's a team that I want to go have a play with and see. I still think they have some bad matchups, but I think they're going to potentially be a massive gatekeeper for elites. Is my current gut feel. The fact that they're now 8 wounds combined with how lethal they are. And it's guaranteed damage. If you're an in-session player and you go, if I roll terribly, you're going to take 10 wounds. It's like a real bad level of damage to take. You go, oh, sweet. That's the worst roll you can get. Oh, nice.
Yeah, because when we were doing our pre-show notes, you mentioned how you were an intercession player. So I was actually curious. I was going to ask you on this very point, like, how do you feel about the Q4 balance data slate for both Legionary and intercession? Phobos, not as much, because Phobos, it's very... toxic for them, because you really just don't have the toughness to stand up to all the shooting threats that are back. It's really Intersection and Legionary Nurgle or Legionary Tzeentch that can still tango, just because you have enough wounds or enough defense where if a Kaskrin shoots you, maybe you don't instantly die. That's not true for Nurgle Legionary. Nurgle Legionary with a Melta, you are guaranteed to die, because they're going to get three hits. One of them is going to be a crit. You're going to take 12 off the bat, and you're just gone.
they're going to remove you. They say, choose a model, remove him. Oh, and by the way, they get to reroll initiative on the next turn, so it's a minimum 58% chance they delete another one. Like, so this guy is going to go through and do something.
Kaskrin as a gatekeeper, especially on In the Dark now, where they probably were not as much of a gatekeeper. Now with a foregrip and a Melta or Plasma in a room, you're like, all right, you just can't walk into the room, where I will delete you for sure. And then afterwards, I will hold the knife, run out through the door, shoot someone else, and then stab someone. Like, it's just too much.
You'll be there. Yeah. So as an in-session player, I think they're going to be my casual team. Like, I'm not going to be playing them in a tournament anytime soon. They've got too many bad matchups now. It was already pretty bad in the sense that, like, because, I think they're a really good core, like, principles team is how I describe them, right? So, like, if you're learning to play the game, like, stop trying to learn how to do all these, like, really cheesy moves and these combos and these synergies. Like, it's way too complicated. Just learn the core principles. They're a team that let you do that. The issue is when you get into a high-level game and both players know the core principles, like, you're out of options at that point. And then with these bad matchups, I think it's really rough. Tzeentch is an interesting one because, like, so Legionary, I think, are the one elite team that still have a chance as such, because it becomes a dice game, right? Like, they can just roll four ups, and it's not necessarily likely, but if they do, they can win. So I think for any Legionary player, like, you're now probably looking at Tzeentch Slaanesh, which is interesting because if you remember, like, when the game first came out, everyone was like, those two are rubbish, you want to be playing like Khorne and you want to play Nurgle. And now we're like full 180 and we go, no, like, those are the wrong choices. You're now on Tzeentch and Slaanesh, which is really cool for their internal balance in a way. So they're probably the marks you need to take against, like, your Hearthkins, against your Kazakin and that sort of stuff. And just touching on the Phobos thing you mentioned, like, survivability of Phobos against those really heavy hitters was predicated on smoke grenades, and that's how they basically won the Kazakin matchup before. And unfortunately now, they can't do that. So the guy just goes, are you hiding in smoke? Here's my all specs. You're not in smoke anymore, and here's a metal guy. And you're guaranteed to take a minimum of 12 damage. You're dead. Yeah. So I don't even know where they do now. But maybe season 3 will help with being able to jump across gantries and whatever else, and you can deny people getting shots on you. I don't know. We'll see how that terrain plays out when it actually comes out, I guess. But as an elite player in general, I'm probably not going to take him to a tournament. I think Tzeentch is your best option. But you're living and dying on rolling a 4 up on a save, which is,
you know, having just played a tournament recently where one of my matchups, I think the final matchup in my round 3 was Kaskrin versus Tzeentch Legionary. Yeah. For the first 2 turns, he made a 6 in every shooting step, and I was like, oh, this is looking kind of sketchy. And at the very last turn, I was able to steal initiative, and then my 1 health Kaskrin, or like 3 or 4 health Kaskrin, basically shot down 2 Legionary that were at low wounds and scored a capture point, and that was how I won that game.
Yeah,
I was like, well, I have one. Basically, like, as I was starting to lose, I was like, I need one model to do 2 things and then score a point. So I passed the APL and I was like, I need to steal initiative, win, win a shooting step, and I got all of it. And this was before the buff. If I had that buff, you know, who knows what could have happened.
And Kaskrin, like, really interests me as a very competitive player, because they can guarantee results, which is something that when you really need something to happen. The amount of times where I go, I'm going to charge into melee, I just need one hit, and it's whiffed, and you go, oh my god, this ruined my entire life. Just being able to go, nope, dice, done, it's sorted, is really cool. And the reroll initiatives, that's one of the reasons I like Star Striders, actually, is when you have a turn, you go, no, like, I need to win initiative, and I just rolled a 1, I'm going to reroll it. Like, that's really impactful at competitive plays. So I think those 2 abilities for the team is really strong, and they have the best comms in the game.
Yeah,
they do well.
And, like, the reposition that opens up so many doors, just, like, that speed from that super flexible dash. And, like, you can use it for scoring opportunities or to, like, deny your opponents, eliminate guards, or to just, like, catapult your Melta across the, like, to a ridiculous just threat range that a lot of people, it catches a lot of people off guard.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, and they have good faction attack ops, they have good archetypes to be able to choose from. So I think they're going to be really, really good. And I think like the interesting thing with Kazakin is the models look awesome. So everyone wanted to play them in the beginning. Their rules were kind of lackluster and people couldn't get the models. But now they've got the models and the rules look cool. So I think we're going to see everyone who goes, I've always wanted to give these guys a go, pick them up, and suddenly there's going to be a whole bunch. So
yeah, I will tell all the listeners, like, the team is actually one that rewards you at every stage of you getting better as a kill team player, because there's the thing that you were mentioning, Ryan, about, like, you got to learn basic principles with Intercession, but Kazakin are relatively basic. You got five gunners and a bunch of dudes with a bunch of bolters. They don't do that much, but, like, as you step up each layer of play skill, you learn something new. You're like, okay, I can reliably shoot stuff, but sometimes combat blades are good, and you learn how to do melee, and then you realize, you know, you can steal initiative, or you can play reposition and react to what your opponent is doing. You get to do that, and then as you go up the layers, you just get more and more stuff as you go. It's just not a very interesting team. Like, everything just is what it is. You just get everything is just, they do it cool, they do it well, but there's no flavor to it. It's like, I got a gun and I get to shoot it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so my advice to people is, when you start the game, play Intercession, and then once you've got your first 5-10 games under your belt, graduate to Kazakin, because I think you're absolutely right. They're really good from a balanced point of view, like what it were, but like from a, I don't know now.
Maybe. Yeah, I suspect they might be a little bit overbalanced now, just because the poor elite players who were like, oh, you know, this is kind of like a coin flip matchup. It's not a coin flip anymore. Yeah, now it's an insane not coin flip.
When they first came out, it was fine because I was like, I'm in Intercession, you know, I'm going to get a crit, I'm going to get a hit with my bolters, and I'm going to fold you like paper, so that's fine. But now they live on one wound and they still do the same amount of damage. So like, you go, oh god, like they're still there and they're still doing like mean things to me. So I put a meme up the other day about it. So we'll see how they do. But elites probably not so good this season, my personal opinion.
Yeah, at least unless they hot patch something like very soon. But we'll see. You know, LVO is coming up. We've got a couple tournaments right around the corner, so we shall see. Hopefully things aren't too out of whack.
Happy to be proven wrong, right? Like it'd be the best thing ever if someone says, no, you're wrong, actually, as each player wins it, or if an Intercession player wins LVO, then you know I'm gonna be
very, very impressed.
I feel like if they did I don't know, chain swords and the doom bolter do pretty good work against 8 wound models. There's something there.
Maybe that's it. Maybe you just have to go all assault dudes and just yeet yourself forwards and just try and chain sword them half. But yeah, we'll see. It'd be interesting.
So if you did go to a tournament, what team would you pick?
So I'm like, most people know that I'm like mainly an Imperium kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So those are the Imperium factions, what I've been looking at the most. Exaction Squad I had like a bit of a run with this season, because they weren't too good and I was enjoying just taking them to random tournaments and just giving them a go and my local league and that sort of stuff. So I'm probably going to look at them. It'll either be them or Kazakin. I don't really know which. I haven't played Kazakin yet, so I'll see. But probably Exaction Squad is who I think I'm going to take. Because they've got some really cool abilities, and they look awesome as well. I think a lot of people don't really realize what they can do. And they weren't that bad before. Like, sorry, post the second round of buffs, whatever it was, they're not that bad. Like, right at the beginning, they were pretty bad. But like now they're like, actually, you know, they're okay. And the change to like the leader's abilities, it's really nice. Like, yeah. It's really good for the team.
Yeah, I think they look really solid, and that's a perfect segue into our next segment, actually, which is the Operative Showdown.
Operative Showdown!
In which, today specifically, we're going to be chatting about the Exaction Squad, picking out some operative combos, like, what are the best ones there? Is there any, like, deep cut tactics that jump out at you of, like, something that no one's talking about that you think is, like, a cool sleeper hit?
Maybe specifically like the dog, you know, other teams have different pairs of models that are fun, but I think Exaction, they have one of the most fun pairs, which is the dog and the handler, basically. Like, have you found any fun ways to use this compared to other teams with normal dogs?
Yeah, so the dog and the leash master. So like, everyone says this team sucks into elites, and generically you're right, they do. But that combo like can put down Incessor, which people don't really expect. So, like, your dog has a ridiculous charge range. Your leash master can move out and get rerolls. And you can flip the dog onto Relentless. So you can charge a really long way with the dog, get him in P1 range. You can move out with your leash master, shoot with rerolls against the guy you're trying to kill with P1, hope to do a fair bit of damage. And then your dog then goes and attacks in combat, Relentless, lethal 5, 4 attacks. And before you know it, you're probably doing 14 damage or more, and you kill yourself an intercessor. So that catches people out, because they go like, oh, it's just like a dog and a guy, and you go, yeah, but they're gonna kill you. And if you're against elves, like, elves hate that combo, because that's a double kill waiting to happen, right? It's like, out comes a dog, he gets you with a lethal five, that's five damage, three damage to follow up, he's killed one elf, the leash master kills another one, double kill. So that's a really cool, like, combo that I quite like about it. But actually, the whole team itself has quite a few combos. So a lot about this team is positioning for your P1, using like your models to be able to give your other models buffs. And it's really the models that people aren't expecting that are the ones that can be most devastating. So like the Revelatum with lethal five, like that triggers P1 really reliably. And with rerolls, and potentially now with Relentless as well, like that's a great combo. So you can use your shield guys to get forwards, you can give yourself denial of rerolls, and then you can be hitting them with lethal five, P1, picking up kills quite easily. So those are things that I quite like to do. And it's one of the one which I think is probably worth talking about, which is he has a combo in himself, and that's if you give your leader the crack grenade and give him 3 APL, because that guy is an absolute beat stick in combat now, because you can make him have a target that's relentless, and you can choose to either make your grenade target or the guy you want to go fight in melee, depending on where your rerolls are that turn. He's going to go yeet himself in there, kill a dude quite comfortably in melee now, and then throw a crack grenade at someone else and probably pick up double kill. So like that combined with the Leashmaster is potentially two double kills and two activations, which is really, really strong for the team. So I really enjoy them. I think they're good fun, and their ability to catch you off guard is pretty good. And now that you have access to Relentless, even the shield guys can get quite good. Like if they're fighting the right guy, Relentless hitting on fours, that's actually now workable. Like before, you just charge into combat and just did nothing and just wait for them to attack you. But now you go, you know what, actually, I'll give it a go because I'm probably going to do some damage, which is pretty cool.
And, you know, because you have Phosphor Lumens, they're not getting rerolls. So you're actually beating most of the melee specialists at around like the 8 or 9 wound mark pretty reliably with your shields.
Yeah. And so like here's an interesting scenario. Let's say you're an Assault Intercessor and you charge the leader. Like you're going to die. And people don't think that, but like statistically you die. Like maybe you hit four, but you probably only hit three. He then goes first. He parries twice. You can hit them or you can parry. Even if either way, he then hits you again with a lethal five and parries the other one because it's stunned now. So he's parried out four dice or three dice and you've hit him for four. And then he's going to hit you for 12. And then you think it's over and you go, oh, thank God I survived that on two wounds remaining. He spends a CP and kills you because he fights first again. So like, you're like, there's no escape from it. It's like, if you charge that model, he's going to kill you. And that is really cool. Like, so even an Assault Intercessor just gets beaten up by the space cop with a shield. So don't get caught out by that. Like he'll take a soul when he needs to.
Yeah, that's the exact punishment attack op, right? So after someone, or it's exact or brutal backup or exact punishment, basically. If you don't die, you get to respond.
Yeah, brutal backup's another great way of doing like potential double kills and stuff, because if you're in combat with someone, like you can fight, and then someone else in that combat can do a fight. So let's say again, so for the Leashmaster is an example of letting your dog do a double fight. So if you've charged someone, you've passed into the turn, and your dog's in combat, you go, cool, I'm going to hit you with the Leashmaster, and they go, all right, a bit boring, and you go, yeah, but the dog's not got you, and out he goes, and then you can charge someone else and fight someone else, which is really cool. So yeah, they got some combos, they have some combos, but they're quite CP intensive to do so.
Yeah, I think before the buff for the Relentless ploy being, you know, anyone at any point, it was a little bit hard to actually set it up. But now your leader can just give Relentless to any one target, and that's great.
Yeah, and I mean, amusingly, I played a game on TTS the other day. We're doing like a little Patreon tournament thing. Every single Relentless reroll I used was a fail, but I was like, but this will be impactful, I promise. Like, I know it doesn't look it because I'm failing everything that I roll, but like, genuinely, this is a good change. So yeah, that will make a big difference, particularly in elite matchup, and particularly with things like the Sniper and the Rebel Arthur and that sort of stuff. So yeah, they've got some abilities, and the Relentless is a really nice buff, like in that matchup in particular.
Yeah, because before their biggest problem was six Assault Intercessors just run at you and you lose.
Yeah, or even just bolter dudes, to be honest. Yeah. Like, you couldn't do anything about it. And they just double tap each one they see, and you go, okay, yeah, that was that. And you just don't have damage output. Like, and then, or even worse than that is Nurgle Legionary, because you just...
Oh, yeah, 3-4. 3-4 is not a good, it's not a good line. Like, I need these guys to die eventually.
They get a crit save anyway. They don't care. It's like you're hitting them for 3 damage, and then you're like, oh, okay, you're still there, are you? Yeah, nice. I guess I'll just die, and you do. So yeah, it's better now. Like, I like the fact that you can at least make your like gunners do something, which before they just couldn't do, which is a nice change. But generically, I think shields, you're probably taking 2 per game, which...
Oh, interesting. Okay. I always figured that you would, most players would be taking, you know, anywhere from 3 to 4 shields a game, just because they are some of your best models. But I guess you're prioritizing some of these combos that have been opened back up with the execution order change, right?
Yeah. So it's a real big balance, right? So I think the only reason you take 4 shields, if you're on a map which has like 4 objectives and you really need those shields and all objectives, like in the midboard particularly. Mm-hmm. Like, so I think you don't want to have too many shields because they're not reliable killers for you. Like they will kill stuff, but they're more like wild cards, is how I describe them. Like, particularly against teams like Felgor, it's hilarious because they'll charge you and you go, I have absolutely no idea who's going to live or die. Like, and they don't know either, right? And it's like no one has, well, I have potentially 1 reroll. You don't have any rerolls. I'm just going to like see what happens. And more often than not, the Felgor dies. Equally, you just roll 1 hit and you die yourself. So like, I've had it both ways. And, so the shotguns do you most of your damage. The shields do most of your like mission play and locking down areas and generating your P1. The only exception for that is the mirror match, which is a mental match where you just everyone runs shields and no one has rerolls, no one dies. Like it's just like people just clubbing into each other all the time. It's really weird. So
a cursed mirror match, if I've ever heard of one.
Yeah, it's like Chaos Cult's mirror match. It's like who knows what's going to happen. I just feel mutating everywhere. Well, not anymore, but yeah.
True, not anymore. Yeah, but, you know, we talked about the commandos nerf maybe not being so sizable, but the cult one probably is a little bit more sizable. Having your, you know, chaos cult devotees not able to mutate quickly is definitely a big nerf to them.
Yeah, I think, interestingly, like, because I think, is it 14 mutations per game they get? So they get 4 from the leader.
4 for the leader and then 1 for every turn. Yeah, so yeah, 1, 2, 6, 10. So 14. If nothing else happens. So which is enough to get, you know, 6 torments.
So I think interestingly that the more impactful change with it is the health regeneration change. Like that the fact that that's gone now is I think more important. So you'll see them probably playing more towards the end of a turning point and then actually getting ready before they go into the next one, doing like a double mutate to get all the wounds back that they need. So that for me is the bigger nerf, but maybe the other one will be more impactful. I'm not 100% sure. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, as far as being a competitive player, you know, talk a little bit about the London community scene that you have. Are you in London, or are you, which part of the UK are you in?
I'm sort of like blessed because I'm sort of like between communities is how I describe it. But so I guess my hometown is not Kill Team. So that's where it's my local community. It's where I play most of my games. But I go down to London a lot for the tournaments. So I usually go to every London tournament. And that's where I started playing a lot of competitive Kill Team because not Kill Team didn't really exist at that point. And now there's all these like local Kill Teams like picking up around me. So I'm right between Knots and Lincoln Kill Team, and they're both growing massively right now. So I'm lucky. Like there's quite a few I can go to. So I guess what sort of stuff did you want to know about London? Is it how to get in contact with them, that sort of thing?
Oh, you know, we just like talking to people who are in their communities to kind of talk about what makes their community special or how they've grown their scenes. Cause I know a lot of, you know, TOs are on here who listen to us on week to week. So we've caught up with Japan and Peru and all these other places. So it's just nice to hear about some other scenes. Obviously your influence has been a little bit more global with the map pack, but obviously you must have done something at your local scene. So talk to us a little bit about them. Maybe I just assumed you were in London. So, you know, tell us about Knots a little bit.
I've done a bit of both. So, first of all, about Knots, let's say, why is Knots Kill Team so successful? Well, I think it's the fact that there is so many people that are invested in that community. It would be like remiss of me not to talk about the local TO and the real hero of the group. It's a guy called Jason. And he is, you know, just like so engaged at all things like community, right? So he doesn't really care about having the sweatiest players in the world who are the best of the game. What he cares about is Liverpool having fun. What that's done is bring more people into the group, made them more competitive and more have more fun, but for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons, right? And so he does an incredible amount of work. And I think like without him, it would be like a really bad place. And I say it's like in a world where like mental health is talked about quite a lot, I think we need more Jasons in the world because he's the sort of person that's always going out and looking after you and make like checking in and making sure that you're good, you know? And he's always giving you something to look forward to. So we need more people like that. And he does an incredible job up there. But he is supported by some people, like some incredible painters, some 3D printers, all that sort of stuff. So whenever he needs something for a tournament, like he has a group of people and he says, "Hey guys, can anyone help me out with this?" And the community just rush to help, which is awesome. And there's too many actually to name because like the group's now probably about 60 people. And you know, everyone chips in, which is just incredible. And it's getting pretty awesome. Like there's about, I'd say, 15 to 20 players every Thursday and Friday just turning up for a casual game night, which I think, I don't know how big the scenes are in America, but I think that's pretty sizable for us. Like, and he just did last weekend, a 60 player tournament. So the scene's getting like progressively bigger. And it's interesting because like I've got connections across the UK. I've got some guys in Manchester, some guys wherever else. And so I first went up to Manchester and they were doing like a I think 24 player tournament, then they went up to 36 and they went to 40 players. And then the London community started going up to 45 players. And then I did the Turnipot Tactics one at 58, and then Knox did 60. So it's like, hey, you know, we are on the upward trajectory here. And really, I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that there's a really good social aspect that comes with it. And once you're in that group, like you're looked after. And Tabletop Impulse, I don't know if you guys watch any of his content, but he was saying like it felt like he was at his local club, which I think if I was Jason and that was my tournament, as like a review of a tournament, someone saying it felt like I was at home is probably one of the best reviews you can have.
Not too spicy, right? Like a chill environment where it's like, yeah, you know, people might be competitive, but you don't feel like there's anything.
Yeah,
anything too crazy going on? Yeah, which
and there's still some like exceptionally good players there, right? Like, some guys.
From you're there, obviously.
but like, yeah, there's like guys from the London community and all that sort of stuff coming up, and you know, a few of our guys from the community are up there, like 1,000 ITC points, whatever. So they're doing really well, and so it's interesting to see that like you can have both, right? And I think it's one of those things where you don't have to. It's not mutually exclusive, and that's the point I think we're trying to drive at the moment. It's just how important the community is and like the good sportsmanship side is, because if you can get that, you'll get more people in, which gives these competitive players more of a reward, right? Because you want to win a bigger tournament, right? Like that's the idea of it. But the only way you grow is to get more players in and get them to stay in. And so I'm hoping we'll do 128 players in June. That's the sort of like the benchmark end of June. And if we can, it'd be awesome to get some international reputation, like representation there. So if you listen to the podcast, you want to come over to Nottingham in June, like last weekend, let's do it. 128 players, we'll make it big.
You guys are trying to compete with Warhammer World, huh?
This is it. It won't be as big as LVO, but you know, hopefully we can make it at least for Europe, one of the bigger ones, I think. So we'll see how it goes.
That would be what, 2 or 3 days, or how many rounds are you guys doing at your local tournaments, you know?
So a lot of the tournaments we do at the moment are single day events. My first tournament that I did was a 2 day event, so it was 4 rounds on 2 days. We had a top 16 cut. So the idea being with that is you can take the sweatiest, most competitive players out of day two, and then run a brand new fresh tournament, and actually it gives a bigger pool of people the opportunity to win more, right? Which is I think better because you want to have a diversity at who you see at the top of the leaderboards. And you want to give people the opportunity to play the game they want to play. So that would definitely be 2 days, the 128 player in June, because you sort of need that many rounds, if I'm honest. And we might even do like a Friday, like mess around in the evening or something like that as well, if we can get the venue and that sort of stuff. So for the people who have traveled a long way is the idea. So that you can make a whole weekend out of it. But we'll probably try and keep it to the Saturday and the Sunday only, because I think if you stretch it into the Friday, for the actual main event, then it's time off work and people struggle. logistics, right? It's what it always comes down to.
Yeah, I think LVO is in a special spot just because it is one of the more established events. So they're going out to Friday. We'll see how it goes. It sounds like it's going pretty well. You know, we've got 150 tickets sold out right now. So hopefully Lesser's Workshop has got enough terrain for everyone. From what I've heard, it sounds like he is. 64 people would be a crazy. 128 would be really good. So hoping in June you guys get that going. And I assume you'll be using your map packs at that point.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. So, like, with all things, I put out a draft packet first to get some community feedback. So, like, version one was kind of a draft, and then there was feedback. We tweaked it. So I'll send out a pack. We'll probably run it at a tournament, see what people think, get some feedback, and then test and adjust. Because with all things, you know, like, there's a lot of gut feeling that goes into these sorts of things, and people go, yeah, I think this is good, I think it's bad. Or maybe it would be better if you did this. And sometimes you have to go through that process to realize that actually your gut was completely wrong, or the other way around, right? And so it'll be interesting to see. But because when I first did the map pack, people said, oh my God, this is way too shooty. This is horrendous. Like, why would you do this to us? I made the second one there. Everyone was like, oh, it's great. I really, really like this. And then along came Chaos Cult. It's like, oh my God, this is horrendous. Why would you do this to us? So, like, we've gone through
a monkey's paw situation.
Yeah. So, it'll be interesting to see what the next teams bring, because, I mean, there might even be some tricks that the Eldari bring or the Scouts bring that are going to completely break the next map pack as well. And we don't know the rules yet. So that's the next thing we need to like start unpacking. But I'm on it, like, to try and make version three. It takes a surprisingly long amount of time. Like, when you're really thinking about each map, it takes a long time to do.
And you happen to release them on Patreon, right?
Actually, the map pack's completely free. The only thing I do on Patreon is, like, if I'm doing like drafts or something like that, I put it on Patreon. But the map packs are on my link tree. So I try to put everything that I think is useful to Kill Team in one place. So if you go to linktree.com/turningpointtactics,
Which we'll have in the link for the show notes for anyone who doesn't know about Turning Point Tactics.
Yeah.
You know, I think when I first bumped into your YouTube channel, it was definitely more on the competitive end. Yeah. You were talking about Intercession bolt rifle breakdowns, but at the World Championships, we were talking about how supporting your local community and making sure that people are invited into the games is probably more important than what the most optimal choice is at any given moment. Because those choices, people will figure out, but, you know, having that one bad situation where someone gets bounced off the tournament scene is they're never coming back.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So, like, the very first playlist, if you go back to, like, the beginning of Turning Point Tactics, it's casual to competitive is what it's called, right? So the whole idea is that you can take someone who joins the game and go, hey, you're not necessarily enjoying tournaments, or you're not doing as well as you think you should be because you don't know these tricks, and you can take them through this, and it, like, at each point of the game, you can give some helpful tips and advice. And the idea of that is about making the game more accessible, but making it so that we don't just see the same people who know things at the top win all the time, and it's about trying to get more people to know more about the game and perform better. And ultimately, like, to become better opponents, right? Because that's what we want, right? We want challenging games. If you go there and you just stomp people for four rounds in a row and you go, sweet, like, what did I learn? That's not enjoyable, in my opinion, anyway. So I like the challenge. I like that. And so I sort of said when I started it, I'm like, my win rate is going to drop as a result, right? Like, I'm telling people how to beat me. I'm happy with this. Like, this is good because it will then mean I learn more as a player, and hopefully the whole community is better off. So that's always been the aspiration, but you're right. It's always had a competitive kind of focus to it, is like how to make you a better player. It's hard to make people better humans, but we'll try. Like,
that's a good line. Yeah. We can make better opponents. We can't make better people.
But we're going to try and do that. And Jason's like really big on that in Knots Kill Team. So we're going to do more of a collab going forwards. And you might have seen, like, we're doing Turning Point 5 now as a slightly more casually focused podcast. And that is exactly the idea of it. It's to talk about the stuff that people probably at the casual level want to hear about, and really to, as well, challenge me on my views, right? Because I think everyone can be guilty, if you're a competitive player, of sitting in, like, a competitive, like, echo chamber, right? Where you just listen to only competitive views and you go, yeah, chess blocks are great and this is really fun, like, and cheese is amazing. If I can outstrap my opponent on turn one and reveal their models, that's a fun experience. And it's only then when you go, like, oh, hey, well, do you guys agree with that? And, like, 90% of people go, you're insane. Like, that sounds awful. And you go, oh, right, okay, oh, I'm the weird one. Like, but you don't know that because you're surrounding yourself, right? So And like that, like those are extreme examples. I'm not saying that everyone thinks that. Like, I'm just giving some stuff.
Yeah, but it's very easy to fall into an echo chamber, especially because competitive players have a certain way that the game plays out, right? Like, you're looking for those very tight decision points on, you know, oh, I have three choices, all of them seem kind of equally good. Which one is going to get me the most value on this turn or the next turn? Whereas, like, the new player is like, all right, I've set up and everyone is on conceal. And then you get shot on turn one, and you're like, I didn't have any fun in the situation.
I'm safe, right? And you go, no, you're not safe. Yeah. And they don't even know why not. And so, well, there's a really interesting point to like that. So Chessbox City is a good example to sort of elaborate on it. But so in my work, we talk about OODA loop, which is observe, orient, decide, and act. And it's a process your brain goes through to make decisions. And that if you can do it faster than your opponent, you have decision advantage, which then means you're likely to win in a combat, right? So the idea being that you do this process. Now, if you're a good player, you can do that process far faster than your opponent can. And if you're a new player, you're going to do it far slower. But the benefit of having a quick OODA loop is that, let's say you're on a chess clock and it takes you 5 minutes to make a decision, and then you make your decision, you act, and then it's your opponent's time. Or your opponent just had 5 minutes to make their decision, and so they just immediately make theirs. And then you're back on the clock again, right? So like, it's like more punishing for new players, where you get this spiral where you go, I was behind on one move, and now I'm spending the entire game behind, and they can never catch up. So yeah, it's probably slightly.
It's definitely biased. I think chess clocks are one of those things where the more competitive you get, the more it makes sense. But then on anyone on the newer end, it is just not fun, because it's just a very alien way to play a game, especially on a game like Kill Team or Magic the Gathering, where you have to talk back and forth so much and just to understand what everyone is expected to do. So when it comes to like talking about intent, the intent is there so that both players can agree to what the board state is. It is not there as a magic, like, oh, I just wanted to do this and then step back from the board and wait for your opponent to agree.
Yeah. And like, yeah. And so Jason, I keep talking about him because he does keep me in check. He made a really good point, which I'm going to use. Was that like he likes Kill Team for the social aspect that happens during the game. But if your opponent's clock is ticking down and you're trying to be social and joke with them, it's like viewed as being rude, right?
Because rude, yeah. Like, you're taking their time.
Yeah, and they're like, I don't want to talk to you. And then it's on your time, and you go, well, do we only talk on my time? Like, how does it work? So what happens is just you get hyper focused and people just click through on buttons, and then before you know it, 2 hours are gone, and you go, sweet, who do I play against again? I don't know, I didn't even look at their face. I was just staring at the table the entire time. So there is an element to that as well, right? Where you want to encourage people to build the social connections, which gets them to come back to the next tournament. And then I get that at the top tables, there's probably an argument for chess clocks, but I think it's niche and it doesn't count that much.
I'm looking. I think we have the UTC finals coming up for Goonhammer. On January 13, 14, we will have $1,000 worth of cash prizes there. So $500, $350, and $150. And I think for those players, I will give you guys clocks for anyone who's coming. You know, only for the people who actually want to win money. If both players want a clock, I'll put a clock. But the explanation for the clock is, no matter, you do everything on the clock. Talking, asking about rules, you have to do on a clock, unfortunately. Just because that's like the nature of once everything is on clock. Like, look, you can't waste someone else's time because that is your resource. Technically, while someone is taking their turn, you get to use some of their time to think. But talking and, you know, chit-chat is not really the point if people want to win $500 and play on clock.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a different game. It's a different environment, right? Some people will like that. Some people won't.
Just like the World Championships was a whole different game compared to what everyone plays for Kill Team. Yeah. Playing these four-hour games. You know, I played a five-hour game at the World Championships. It's a very different environment when you have different time parameters for these games.
Anyone who's played TTS, particularly last edition TTS, can probably appreciate what the World Champs was like. It was it's one of those things where you sign up for a game and suddenly it's 4 hours later and you're on 20.2 and you go, what happened? But because as well, like, because you have so long, people would just take the time, and there's no reason for them not to. So I found it interesting. It was a very different play experience, but it was fun all the same. You know, it was a different challenge, if nothing else.
Yeah. Star Striders on 4 hours, easier or harder than Star Striders on 2 hours? Because that is, you know, today's niche tactics, right, Jason?
That is absolutely right. The next segment of the podcast is, in fact, niche tactics, and we are talking about the Star Striders.
Niche tactics.
We've chatted a little bit more about the competitive sweaty stuff, and let's hit some competitive sweaty combos for the Star Striders.
That sounds good. So to answer your question initially, I think having more time to play against Star Striders is massively beneficial, because one of their main things they do is their orbital strikes and that sort of stuff, which is a lot of angles, and you can catch people out. And if you have the enough time in the world to measure every angle and predict everything, you're probably going to be fine. But if you don't have that long, that's where they can catch you. So that's the first thing I want to say about Star Striders, is their ancillary support is one of their main strengths. But, you know, it's against experienced players, it's less likely to strike and hit hard, and you have to work more to get it going. But there's a few things that I think is probably worth touching on with Star Striders, because I thought it was really interesting, which is your potential to go 4-2 on turn one is absolutely massive. And that's because they're one of the fastest factions in the game, and they can do a lot of stuff like Vetguard, which people just don't foresee at all. So, for instance, and this is a demonstration of their speed, right? So you can spend a CP to give them plus one move. Everyone knows that. And you can do a pre-game dash to get someone 3 inches forwards. But you can also GA2 two people and give them an extra APL right at the start of the game. So that's now two people moving 10 inches at the start of the game to be able to loot two objectives on turning point one before your opponent takes any activations. That's really, really strong. Combine that with the fact that you have a 3 APL assassin that can do the same thing, and Electromeister with a move dash and free mission actions do the same thing. Like, you can loot four objectives turn one with like a set of combos there, should you want to. And some of them cost CP, some don't. But there's a whole bunch of options to be able to do that. And they also have the fact that you have the Candid, which is like a really, really fast dog model, just to be able to basically place 2 APL on whichever capture objective you need to be able to hold it for next turn. So you go, oh, hey, you want more APL on that objective over there? Oh, it happens to be 11 inches away. Don't worry, dog, off you go. Or dog over to the one on the right, wherever you need it. So you can move your APL around really, really fast. So they are a very, very quick team. I think that catches a lot of people off guard. They also have potentially like one of the most, I think, devastating turn two opening moves, which is a combination between the Void Master and their crack grenade guy. So again, it's GA2 within 6 inches, and you can reroll initiative as well to make sure you get the opening move. But the Void Master can double shoot with a shotgun, which is 4-4 damage hitting on twos, which is an absolute beast. He also has the pistol hitting on threes, double balanced, which is really nice. And then the crack grenade guy can be double balanced hitting a crack grenade. Against like 7 wound models, you're probably killing 3 guys at the start of your like opening gambit on turn two. And the Void Master is such a beat stick, he's probably going to be there at the end of turn two. And that terrifies people. Like, yeah, like everyone looks at him.
For listeners who don't know, just to level set for the rules here, the Void Master has a free just a scratch. You can give him a bolter, you can give him a 4-up save. He comes with balanced on the pistol automatically. Ryan already mentioned 4 attacks on twos, 4-4. And then you can give him lethal proximity, which is a strat ploy to give you a reroll while you're within 6. And because you have to use the short range profiles, you are within 6. So you can have 2 models go and just destroy 3 dudes with 7 wounds very easily on turn 2, which is crazy, crazy fast.
And then if you put him on an objective, he gets half damage on 1 dice as well. So this guy, like, you look at him and you think he's just a normal human on 8 wounds, but actually he's an assault intercessor. Like, that's actually who you're against. So yeah, he's that strong, and people don't see it coming. So that's a really good double, like an opening move for a lot of opening damage. And you talk about lethal proximity there. He also has that aura of 4 inches to give another reroll to Voidman, which again is really, really strong. So double rerolls and your crack grenade and that sort of stuff as well. So they're a surprisingly durable team, so long as you position them correctly, right? So you want to be moving up, you want to be sitting on those objectives, you want to be getting that half damage. If you're against a shooting team, taking the 4-up save is worthwhile. If you're against a melee team, just go for increased damage output with other stuff, I'd suggest. And you can really sort of like do some cool moves with that. There's one which is a bit more of a niche thing that I think people will overlook, but it's actually saved my bacon a couple of times and really helped me get through some tough matchups. So on ITD, like, quite often people will take the opportunity to shoot straight away as the best option, but actually guard is a better option for you. So, for instance, you can, with 3 APL on your, like, heavy gunner, you can move, dash, and guard next to a model that you want to kill. Like, let's say it's a big elite model. Get within 2 inches of them or get an angle to be able to shoot them, but then not shoot right then. Then call in your orbital asset with a laser beam to do your initial set of damage and then shoot afterwards. So you have like this ability to do like a double shoot that people aren't expecting. And that can be really powerful. And you can it also gives you that activation advantage to keep going forward. So there's quite a few times where I'll move people just to within two inches of an enemy. But I'm not going to shoot, but I'm going to just go on guard. I'm then going to call in an orbital asset where I want it to be. And then if they're not dead, I'll then use my guard later on to make sure they die. But I've just given myself an extra activation because that's what I need in the moment. So like you have to look at this like this this orbital asset as both an offensive weapon, but also as a stalling tool for you to be able to like increase your activations when you need them. And or potentially avoid Overwatch by not using it and that sort of stuff. So it can be really powerful in that sense. And that's what I really like about the team. I like how flexible they are. I like how durable they are. I like the fact that their APT weapon is wherever you need it at any time. Like it's across the board, right? And you can't just kill it. You have to kill all the guys first. So yeah, like they've got a lot of tools. They're very thematic. They're very fun to play. They're very explosive. They're maneuverable. They're durable. But they just suck into commandos.
Yeah, they do suck into commandos. That doesn't go away. The trick that you're mentioning here, just mechanically, so anyone who doesn't play a ton of In the Dark or doesn't know, is that on In the Dark, you can go on guard with a heavy weapon, and because you are not actually shooting with the heavy weapon, you ignore the heavy penalty. So you just take the Overwatch penalty, and because the rotor cannon has balance, or not balance, it has relentless, you can move dash 9 inches, go on guard, and just nuke someone with the gun. But you'll be hitting on fives. But with relentless, that's fine because you got six dice.
Do a lot of damage.
And the other plus side here is you actually open up more opportunity for you to see what your opponent is doing. Like even outside of just the extra opening for you to fire a laser on a guy, now you've given yourself, your opponent has to commit to either dealing with this guy, doing something else. And because guard windows happen at the end of every action, the moment your opponent makes a move, you can go ahead and take that guard, even if it was on the primary target. So that's just a set of mechanical things that maybe not everyone is in the know about on In the Dark. Because I know at the World Championships, there were a handful of regions, I think Mexico specifically, didn't play a lot of In the Dark. So they were learning In the Dark the Saturday and Sunday, or like the Friday of. So for anyone who doesn't know, those are things that will come up. I'm sure with the new terrain that's coming, we're going to be learning a whole new set of just specifically terrain tricks. So good luck, everyone.
Yeah, climbing ropes and jump tests. We're there. Here it comes.
Climbing ropes, jump test. How does obscurity work? And, you know, how does climbing work? Well, all of these things will be very important very soon.
But yeah, so Star Trek is an amazing team. Like, they're really fun to play. They do have some bad matchups, but overall, like, I think you can make most things work. I think people think the elite matchup's worse than it is. That the legionary matchup's pretty bad, particularly if they're Tzeentch, which is probably going to be more Tzeentch legionaries going forward. So like, I don't know what you do now, but but yeah, generically, it's not as bad as people first think. I think
it is manageable. I feel like the Star Striders elites matchup is a series of kind of like 50-50 shots. There, the Star Striders get like three or four of them, and if you don't delete the first assault intercessor, then suddenly the assault intercessor has now killed two of your models. You're like, I don't want it to be there.
Yeah, yeah. Cause like things like the Electromeister with lethal four up and the splash. Like he, if you give him the relentless for the CP, like save CP for it, you can get like a surprising amount of damage out with that. And so, particularly if you hit all four, like it's just like that guy's dead. But like,
And that would be combined arms.
Yeah, combined arms.
Yeah, so combined arms is as long as someone else has shot at the operative, then someone else can get relentless. So the Electromeister, four attacks on fours, 4-4, lethal four, splash two. So you're 4-6 with relentless is definitely enough to kill a Marine. Yeah. But all of these plays cost CP along the way. So you're like, you got to pick which pair of operatives, where they spend the CP. And then once you spend it, it either works or it doesn't. Because 4 attacks on 4 is relentless. I have watched it delete stuff, and I've also hit one time. I'm like, great, I'm going to lose now.
And that is it. So like, say the you have an ability to take an extra CP with this team, and you always have to do that. Like, I never have enough CP with this team.
I have consumed I think I've played that team like a couple times in practice, and then I realized, like, you know what, I always take CP, and I think I almost always ended up taking the equipment. Are you playing recon or security a little bit more?
Generically, I play recon. I think there is some times for security, but I think recon is a better pick. And it's because you can do like some funny things with them. So most teams, you don't want to put like an operative just on a vantage point to do nothing. But Star Striders, actually, that kind of works quite well. Because like, it's like, I'm going to run a voidman up there, and he's going to give me an angle for a laser beam. and he's going to not die, and he's going to score me a VP. Well, that's a good trade. I'm happy with that. And their Undaunted Explorer works really well with Surge Forward. So the two synergy works well because it's if you're on objective or within 6 inches of your opponent's drop zone, and to score Surge Forward, you need to be within 6 inches of your opponent's drop zone. So it's like, oh, hey, if I get to the point where I want to be for my VP, I also get a damage reduction. Well, that works really well. So, and they're fast, so they get there. So it's like those work well, and the dog can get recover item. So I've been pretty impressed with Recon. I'm sure there is some instances to take based on map and matchup security, but generically, my advice would be stick with Recon. It's served me pretty well.
Yeah, I found that with only 10 operatives, security tends to get harder and harder as the game goes on, just because C's access point is not guaranteed with only 10 operatives floating around. Because I feel like in most games, I end up with about 4 operatives, and they're generally kind of scattered whereabouts all across the map. Whereas, like, C's point, I got to have 2 dudes on this thing by the end of the game, which is not a guarantee with Star Striders and 10 operatives.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the Void Master doesn't live that long. Like, he lived a long time, but not that long.
And I've generally found that my Void Master is doing probably like 50% of the work most of the games. Just like the move relentless, or not like a move balance, you know, killing 2 dudes and then having someone else chain activate. Whereas like my assassin generally does one thing and then dies because she goes out, kills a dude, and then she's standing in the open a lot of the times. You're like, there's no cover for me to get into. So yeah, she's just gonna get shot to pieces. You know, the 6-up, 5-up, the 5-up, 6-up combination doesn't generally keep her alive that long. And then Vayne goes in, but sometimes she just hits 4 normal hits, and you're like, all right, she's going to die too. I think Vayne having 4 attacks on 3s, 3-6, you know, lethal 5, means that every once in a while she just has a series of 3 damage normal hits, and she doesn't do anything.
Just whiffs. And that was like, I think where my big whiffs with Vayne was trying to fight a injured commando, and it was like, if I can, I get a reroll for a start, I've got a CP to reroll again, and I just need 2 crits because he's just going to just scratch the first one. I just couldn't get it. And I was just like, oh, come on, just give me this. Spent so much CP down the drain. I'm like, lethal 5. Yeah.
I think the laser beam chase, you know, you do 4 attacks on 6-7 AP2 and you get 1 hit. You're like, all right, I'm going to go reroll.
My worst instance of that was I was playing Camille at the champs. Mm. And he had his axe jack in the open. I rolled my laser beam, got a single crit hit, and I was like, do I CP reroll? And I was like, no, what's the chance of him rolling a 6 on his defense dice? Like, this was like a 2-wound axe jack, right? I'm like, he's not going to roll it. He rolled a 6. And I was like, of course you have. Like, of course you have. Lost me the game. And I was like, I should have CP rerolled one of those bloody dice. It would have been a miss anyway, but I should have done it just to make myself feel better. So... these things happen, your point in the Voidmarsh is absolutely correct. Like, he is the one guy that can kill a commando, and
he can do anything. Like, he can do anything and then stay alive for an extra turning point, and then he's just standing there menacingly for the next turning point. But he can do anything out of the whole team. I played them a fair amount. I played them at a Kill Team Open, and I was practicing with them, you know, for this year, and I really enjoy them. Their playstyle is super fun. They are very good at taking conversions. So if you're a hobbyist, I've seen some very beautiful, like, Rogue Trader, like, custom boards where you have, like, a ship on the top and then they're inside the decks. Like, they take the conversions great, but Voidmaster has to do a lot of work, and everyone else looks like they do a ton, but they're way less consistent than the Voidmaster with 2 guns balanced, you know, carrying a crack grenade or a frag grenade with balance. Because, you know, if you have one of your dorks with a frag grenade, chuck it out a pile with balance. It's a ton of dice normally.
He's amazing. I genuinely, there's very few things he doesn't kill when he makes contact with him. Did you see at Wormworld, did you see Tibbs Star Striders, the French guy?
I played against him. Losses with Pathfinders against Tibbs, I think I made maybe like 2 mistakes, but the bigger mistake was I rolled 3 different shooting attacks with 5 dice and I only landed 2 hits and he saved out. So, you know, that's fine. You know, 15 dice on 4s, and I got, like, I think 3 or 4 hits total. That was probably my bigger mistake, and that one's on me.
Yeah, they looked incredible. So you're right, and it's like the old Rogue Trader models are perfect for the team. They fit so well. So, they're an awesome team. I highly recommend them to anyone.
Yeah, I think they're super fun. They're also very rewarding, but they are much more complex than something like Caster Kin. Like, Caster Kin reward you at every step. You, like, learn the rules. They're not that hard, and you keep going up. Sarce Riders, it's like you have to learn everything just to start playing, and then it just gets harder and harder as you go up.
Well, that was cool. I went to Spain where I won my gold ticket with them. I said I came second, but the other guy already had it. But like, I finished that tournament and I was like, I think I'm at like 50% with this team. Like, I haven't even scratched the surface of what this team can do. And I learned so much more when I was at champs, and I still think that there's probably another 40%.
Yeah, they're super fun. You have to learn positional play. Like, the first step is you learn how the laser works. You learn how to position for the laser, and then you start seeing like, oh, I can also position my defensive stuff to bait people into reacting to the laser, so I get defensive rerolls. The invuln save models, Vayne and the Assassin, are really good on rooms on in the dark with the Void or Electromeister behind them, because the aura goes around walls, so you can actually do two rooms on Conduit defensively with the Voidmaster, which is really funny. So you can bait people to like, all right, I'm gonna go take these shots. But against the 4 up invuln or 5 of invuln and 4 dice, probably not going to kill them, and then they can just run away. The medic is insane. You know, she's got the 3-inch bubble of actual medic and the 6-inch bubble of no injuries, so you can move her into position, chuck a dude at your opponent, where they have to kill that model.
Best medic in the game ever. Like,
and you can even just heal yourself. Like, if the assassin kills someone and is alive, the next turn, if there's no one in range of her, she can pop the med kit on herself and just run and do someone else. There's a ton of layers. It's just, at the end of the day, there is a limitation on how many commandos you can mulch in a game with 7-8 wound models where half of them are melee.
I think the issue is, like, they do a lot of burst damage, but it's like a lot of damage in a single thing, and like just a scratch can ruin that. So like, just a scratch can mean that your assassin doesn't get a kill and just dies. Just a scratch can mean that Vayne doesn't get a kill and just dies. And your mega laser doesn't work. So like, those kind of things is what really hurts. Because like the commando knob, for instance, like, even if you hit everything with the mega laser, like, you don't kill him. Because if he's on, like if he makes his 4-up save, which he probably will, he just scratches another one, takes 12 damage, he's left with one wound remaining, and you go, like, just hit you with, like, you have to get crits.
It's an orbital laser that the knob just, like, eats.
It's like a literal spaceship is shooting into his head, and he doesn't care. He just goes, oh, it's just a scratch. Because you have to get two crits, because he's going to just scratch the crit. So, like,
yeah, absolutely.
And that's the one of the strongest weapons in the game. And I'm like, that guy just does not care.
Yeah, he does not care. Not even a little bit. Yeah, no, Star Striders are in a really fun place. I think, if I were going to nerf them just a little bit, it would be the Rotor Cannon goes to Ceaseless over Relentless. I don't think it needs Relentless, personally. But, you know, it's not like the team is crushing tournaments left and right, so.
Yeah, I spoke the other day. So when I was, Mateusz and Elliot at Warhammer Champs Service asked me if I thought they needed nerfs, whatever. And I was like, I don't think so. Like, I think they're a team that really rewards, like, player expression and player skill. But I've never, like, I don't feel like I'm absolutely crushing someone. Like, I don't know if you remember when, like, Pathfinders first came out, or, you know, like, it was just, I played a game with them, I just felt dirty afterwards, so I was like, oh, I've just, like, it was like, I did 4 activations, and I just killed your entire team, and you didn't get to move. That was, like
I feel, it wasn't... I feel like they probably need a little bit nerf, but it's only because at the edges of their matchup spread, you basically have mostly good matchups. And on these handful of spots, it'd be nice for them to have weak points. Like, part of the reason why elites are so rough for elites is that you have a couple close range threats and a couple long range threats, and they have to respect all of them. And the rotor cannon is a free one that they get, which I don't think they really need for that for all of their other matchups to be good. Like, if you lose the ceaseless, like, if you go from relentless to ceaseless, they still are good against the 7-8 wound models, but then they're worse against the elites, which I think would be nice. You know, no, talking about that, because Shane, in his matchup on Conduit at World Championships, he had a rotor cannon just delete a full health Nurgle Legionary because they got, I think, like, 5 hits or something.
I mean, statistically, that's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. But, like, the thing is, Relentless does allow you to just spike those much harder. Like, 6 dice on 4 is Relentless, or 6 dice on 5 is Relentless on guard is a lot of dice. Like, throwing 10 dice, getting, you know, 4 or 5 hits is not that insane.
I can see it as well, because then potentially it brings in the fact if you have lethal proximity, if you have the Void Master, you can be getting...
Yeah, it forces you to play a little bit more, whereas, like, right now, when it had no rules, it was bad. It needed some sort of innate reroll or something, like P1 or something. But when it first came out, I was like, oh, this gun is worthless. And then at Relentless, it's too consistent, I think. So I think just trimming a little bit would be nice. But that said, Star Striders, it's not like they're crushing everyone. I think they're a really fun team. They reward player skill. So I'm excited to see how this new season takes to them. I assume they will remain very good in this season.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting because I think a lot of the teams, like I said earlier on, I think Commanders are going to hang around for a bit. I think Kazakin are probably going to do okay into this team. And I think, I don't know, I think like Gellipox is quite a difficult matchup. Felgor is a really difficult matchup. I don't really know how you win that one too easily. You have two access of lethal five, I guess.
I think what I've seen, like the big weak point for Felgor, for anyone who's worried about Felgor coming up, I think the Kasterkin are one of the best examples of a never winnable matchup for Felgor, because you shoot them, but you never kill them. You take combat blades, so everyone is appreciable in melee. So I think I would probably run into that kind of skew for the Star Striders as well, where you just take bolters across all the dorks and you take your crack grenades and just try to injure them as they come in. Because if you can get into melee, you do have enough dudes who can get crits semi-reliably where you can continue the game afterwards. And the laser is good. And if you're hitting five attacks on fours, 3-5 against the Felgor, that is a pretty good blast profile that can chip but not kill Felgor, which is not what they want to do. They want to be at full health when they hit you. They want to be able to go to a fight, kill you, stay at two, and then have you deal with them because then they get to hit you again. So the Felgor matchup is like, can you injure them but not kill them? Is what it feels like.
And weirdly, I think it's almost better on ITD for them because they have the frag grenade that can have lethal five and they have the assets can have lethal five. So suddenly, if you have a frenzied guy in the open, you can just be like, well, I'm now going to hit you with an asset and probably kill you and do chip damage to all your friends that are nearby. So, yeah, it's definitely true. There's some play there, but I think they'll trade too efficiently. Is my gut like if you're not giving away free shots early on, which most good focal players don't. We had a really good player running them the other day in London, coming third. But you know, there's. Having spoken to other Felgor players, they also have some really terrible matchups, and they do have some really terrible matchups. Like Exaction Squad, they don't like, for instance. They don't like Gellibox. They don't like Hunter Clay. It's probably pretty terrible for them as well. A bunch of infiltrators were turning off rerolls and lethal five blades and some nasty shooting.
I'm excited. I'm excited. Yeah, Jason here has been playing Felgor a little bit on TTS, I think.
Yeah, and like in the local stuff and noodling around, and they do have a lot of bad matchups, and like people, like especially like people that haven't played them, there's like they have like 10 million questions, so it makes it take forever, and then like it's, you can just like measure to be outside of their threat range, and then people will take a super long time to like carefully measure out of your threat range, and it just, it feels like as soon as Felgor come out, everyone slows down by like 30% and asks like 200% more questions.
It is an interesting matchup as well, because like it's one of those few games, it's like them and Gellipox, where you just come out with like your whole team on engage. It's like here we go, boys, like guns blazing, we're in. And it plays so differently to a lot of other teams. And so you are like on turn one, just at the, can I get enough distance up the board to be able to threaten stuff? And if you can, good, and if you can't.
Yeah, Felgor, I think old Void Nanthers also had this issue where, you know, you had a 6-inch max range, so everyone just gets a setup on full engage and force you to play perfect, which is rough.
Yeah. But now they have the long range Death Jester, which kind of took
out. Yeah, I think the Void Dancer matchup was, we get two long distance guns, and in response we get worse Domino Field, and they have been nerfed like 5 times since then, so now they just can't beat the teams that are bigger, like much wider than them.
There's always a thing with Domino Field is that, like, everyone's, like, because it was worse, but actually in application, the change was, like, negligible. Having a vantage point within 6 inches of the light cover of the model, that was, like, there were so many things you had to stack. It just meant they had to use conceal orders. It was, like, the jump in intellect between, like, the team one and team two was, hey, can I use conceal now? Like, oh, yeah, it's actually really strong. So,
you know, I've bumped into Void Dancer players multiple times where they're playing a different team. They're like, how does climb work? I'm like, you've been playing this game for a year and a half, but it's like, it's just like, they've never read this part of the rule book. Cause why would you, when you fly? Really? It's like, can you move past your own models? Like, no, you can't. You actually can't. So there's a whole layer of those rules that are like, people are learning. And Felgor is, you know, Felgor's like, oh, I can start on engage on turn one. Nice.
Yeah. And so, like Felgor, I said, I don't know. For instance, Corsair's a lot of lethal five. They've got Hunterclade's a bad matchup. Kazakin's a bad matchup. Blooded's probably a bad matchup.
They're an interesting team. They've got lots of fun tools, and now that they have the extra buff, they can actually play a game rather than just, you know, I only get to play the Seek and Destroy Prey plan versus now I can play a little bit of positional play. So they're in a much better spot. We'll see. I think, you know, I'm sure they'll be at LVO and all the other stuff. You know, we're hitting close to the end of our time today. And I just want to give out a call out, you know, last shout outs. You know, Ryan here has got a very successful competitive to casual or casual to competitive YouTube channel, Turning Point Tactics. And we'll make sure we have links to both your YouTube channel and if you want to put your local shop Discord channel, we'll make sure that everyone has a chance to see that in case anybody wants to go to this 128 person tournament in June, I think, of 2024. Yeah.
End of June is the last weekend of June is the plan, and it'll be in Nottingham, so it's hopefully easy for everyone to get to, but it'd be awesome to see some like international people coming up to it, and maybe you could even squeeze in a trip to Warhammer World if you want to make the pilgrimage, because it's very local, so come on over, I guess.
And you know, for anyone still listening, there will be a cash prize tournament in January that Goonhammer is putting on, the Unified Tournament Circuit Finals. That'll have a kill team open. It'll be $500, $350, $150 cash prizes for 2 days of play over five rounds. So if you guys want to come and you're in the Northeast area, come by. Not all the games will be crazy sweaty, but definitely at the top end, I expect there to be some chess clocks when $500 is on the line. Anything else from you, Jason?
Thanks for listening. Thanks for staying until the end. If you haven't already left a review, definitely do that.
Thanks again for coming on, Ryan.
Where it's still, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.